It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Veterans Affairs held a field hearing in La Crosse. The topic of the day was looking at returning service members' experiences transitioning to civilian life.
Republican Representative Derek Van Orden of Wisconsin chairs the House Subcommittee on Economic Opportunity. In opening remarks, Van Orden says he wants to improve the VA Transition Assistance Program, citing data from the Government Accountability Office.
A recent GAO study found that more than 4,300 at-risk service members did not receive the warm handover assistance that was needed. 4,300 of our brothers and sisters. And too many of them were falling through the cracks.
That hearing audio courtesy of C-SPAN. Dwayne Honeycutt is executive director of the Milwaukee Regional Office of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and an Army veteran. Dwayne, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
So glad to be here. Thank you for the invite.
And Adrian Marino is a senior at UW La Crosse, testified at the hearing, and Marino previously served in the Mississippi National Guard and the Wisconsin National Guard. Adrian, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Dwayne Honeycutt, directing this to you as you testified before this House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee, what does this panel seek to do? What do they want to find out?
I believe the panel wants to do everything they can legislatively to improve the veteran transition experience. That would be folks that are on active duty that are transitioning to out of the military to civilian life. There are several aspects of that, and there's areas that I believe we can always do better and learn. A good part of the hearing was the fact that we had actual veterans on the second panel testify and explain the experience that they went through.
Adrian, you spoke at this field hearing about your experience as a returning service member and a student at UW La Crosse. What have been some of the challenges that you encountered in that transition? What did you tell this panel?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I would say that the main thing that I wanted to put an emphasis on was the seemingly lack of guidance that I, just like other veterans, usually experience upon transitioning in. We're aware that there are programs out there and there are a lot of people working hard that want to help us and want to see us succeed. However, it does seem like it takes a bit of scavenger hunting, in a sense, to figure out where that guidance is and how we can be reached. And it can be very discouraging and a lot of people fall out from that experience.
What are the emotions like during that separation period and trying to find your footing and trying to get acclimated to college life? What was that like for you?
That's a really good question. I would say it's definitely starting from scratch again, in a sense. I can't recall who said it at the hearing, but to put it plainly, it's essentially you're starting from ground zero. All the accolades, all the position that you had before, it seemingly doesn't mean anything. And it can often feel like the past few years that you just spent doing this and dedicating yourself to almost seems like it was for nothing. Like in truth, you know, it wasn't. But at the same time, that environment kind of gives that inclination of a feeling, especially when no one could relate to that experience or experiences that you had yourself. So the more you struggle, the harder it is to kind of reach out to other people that can kind of at least empathize where you're coming from.
Dwayne Honeycutt, do you hear that sentiment? Do you see that in programs that you work on?
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with Adrian. I went through that experience several years ago when I transitioned out of the military. I would just add, I had the experience of being a little bit older and going back to college in oldest one in the class. I guess the positive about it was I had a lot more discipline to apply myself to the learning, and thus my grades were better. But I don't discount anything that Adrian is saying. It's certainly some things have changed, some things have not.
Congressman Derek Van Orden honed in on the VA's Transition Assistance Program, TAP, and really saying, like, look, that needs to change. What are the challenges you see with this program? Where isn't it serving what it needs to do, Dwayne Honeycutt?
Yeah, part of the certainly part of the challenge is some of the folks going, or when the soon to be veterans are going through TAP, that they're it's a lot of information. It's like they're bombarded, they're overwhelmed, sometimes for several days. And when maybe Adrian can relate to this, but when you go and to get out of the military, there's a lot of thoughts and emotions that are going through your mind. And one of the main things is getting back home. Hmm. And that bombarding of information is sometimes it's too much and it's not absorbed. And the challenge is to get that information to those folks. But I think we could do a better job than just doing it right at the end, right before they get out. I think during somebody's military career, at certain learning points, I think that dissemination of that information would be better, would better serve the veteran.
We're talking about this experience of veterans returning to civilian life in Wisconsin with Dwayne Honeycutt there, Milwaukee Regional Office of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And Adrian Moreno is with us, served in the National Guard, now getting a degree at UW-La Crosse. Adrian, at the hearing, you recommended some specific campus support systems for returning service members. What kind of resources and programs do you think would make the biggest difference?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Just like Dwayne was talking about earlier, discipline necessarily isn't too often the issue with veterans coming through. It's often that, like you said, we're bombarded with information, we're just trying to get back home, and we're also trying to start personal aspirations of ourselves. What I saw initially going into school was basically no one, but what I took a lot from was the overwhelming, welcoming experience that we give to freshmen that are leaving high school and entering their first year at school. This, in a way, kind of helps steer students in a way, calms their nerves and gives them some kind of direction. Because, you know, there's a lot of younger people that don't know what they want to do quite yet, even after starting school. And that's fine. We shouldn't punish people for that. My directive, I would say, is more so, okay, here's what you can do to make sure you're staying on track. Here's the resources you can reach out to. Here's the campus environment. This is what the campus is all about. The same way that we do for freshmen. Here at La Crosse, we do Eagle Fest. That's starting next week. And we do Involvement Fest the very week after. And the entire time, even if students don't really care, you have a lot of things in your face that are going, hey, welcome to La Crosse. This is what we're about. Are you interested in this? Are you interested in this? If not, that's totally fine. There's plenty of things. Just reach out, give somebody a holler. For veterans, it's welcome to La Crosse. You're basically an adult because, you know, all of us serve for a number of years before you know, we go to school. So, no, you don't need that walk in. You don't need that walkthrough. Here's where your classes are. Here's this, this, and that. And yeah, it's direct information, but there's a lot of small things that go into it. And any veteran that has served knows for a fact that it's the little things that do count.
Looking for a more formalized orientation that is specific to student veterans. I wonder, Dwayne Honeycutt, what did you learn from the field hearing? What were some of your big takeaways?
Certainly, the best thing for me was to hear from those veterans themselves that are going through or went through that transition. These are real stories, and they're very individualized. Every veteran's just like a fingerprint, and some struggled more in areas than others. Some of the issues they brought up were certainly related to Department of Defense. Some were related to their college experience. Others certainly were related to VA. I would suggest, or I would offer something. I have had experience in my time here in Wisconsin with University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus. They have a specific student veterans group that is a student advocacy group other than Student Veterans for America. And not only are they a support group, but they have also been instrumental in assisting some students there in the transition. And, although I have no authority over the University of Wisconsin system, to me, that is a model that never existed years ago when I transitioned. And I think if it did, it would have gone a lot easier.
Adrian, I want to land with you here. Knowing what you know now, what you experienced going to university after serving, what advice do you have for other veterans returning to civilian life, perhaps entering that college environment?
Thank you. I would say that knowing what I know now, that just like what the military has taught us, it's fine to ask questions. It doesn't seem like it often enough, and it seems discouraging too, but it's totally fine to ask questions. Go straight to the office, go and ask. If you don't know if that person will know, they will know someone who does. And take that initiative. I stand by what I said at the hearing, that all veterans possess two inherent skills, adaptability and resilience. And we often think that just because of the structured setup of school that we don't have to really be as adaptable anymore, but that's anything but the case. Adapt to the situation, take advantage of opportunities, ask questions to people around you, because you never know what someone next to you might know.
Adrian and Dwayne, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
That was Dwayne Honeycutt, Executive Director of the Milwaukee Regional Office of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and Adrian Marino, a Wisconsin National Guard veteran and senior at UW-La Crosse. We talked with them last week about the experience of service members returning to civilian life and what kind of programs and resources could better support young veterans.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a school nurse tells us why a gradual decline in vaccination rates has her worried about diseases like measles.
Really, when you look at the data, we've always had difficulty with that one in particular because it is so highly contagious. And we just have seen that outbreak in a much lower vaccinated population just across the border in Minnesota.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's back-to-school season in Wisconsin, and as students kick off a new school year, the State Department of Health Services reports that vaccination rates among students have gone down over the last year. That rate has been around 89% over the last few years, dropping from around 92% in the years before COVID.
How are school nurses dealing with vaccination concerns and preparing for the upcoming school year? Jamie Trebetuski is a school nurse for the School District of Waupaca. Jamie also leads the Wisconsin Association of School Nurses. Jamie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We have these new numbers from the state now. About 11%, almost 11% of school-aged children not meeting those minimum vaccination requirements for attending school. That's a worse number than usual. What are your thoughts on that? What does this end up meaning?
Yeah, so it's always concerning when you see a drop in numbers like this. But when you really kind of look back at the data, we've had a change from about, you know, 92.5% around the 14-15 school year to this new number of this 89.2 for this oncoming school year. It has been a gradual decline over time. And there's just a lot of places where people can get information nowadays. And unfortunately, sometimes that information isn't always accurate, but it certainly comes from a place where parents are trying to do the best thing for their kids. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where sometimes when they're running into places where they're getting information that meets some predisposed conceptions of what they already feel about it, it's dropping that rate a little bit further.
People might hear, okay, a drop of 3% in vaccination rates. 3% doesn't sound that big, but we're kind of playing a numbers game here, right? If there's one kid unvaccinated for, say, measles, well, they can't spread that. If there's two, well, there's two people who can spread, and it's exponential. The more unvaccinated kids, the more shots that measles has to spread, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think measles is a great example. When you're talking about that kind of catchphrase of herd immunity, that rate of herd immunity is different depending on how contagious a disease is. measles, I believe, is because it's so contagious, it's someplace around 95% you'd have to have vaccinated in order to really kind of stop it or prevent it from spreading. So really, when you look at the data, we've always had difficulty with that one in particular, because it is so highly contagious. And we just have seen that outbreak in a much lower vaccinated population just across the border in Minnesota. So, you know, that is concerning. And the more those rates drop, especially if, you know, measles is one thing because it's so contagious, but we'd have an easier time stopping things with our rates if they remained high. But yeah, it is concerning, and it's still something to be watching, and it's a great thing to be collecting data on and making sure we're trying to move that metric absolutely as much as we can.
As a school nurse, do you have the opportunity to talk to parents, whether individually or as a group, about vaccinations?
I would say it's definitely individual. This is the time of year we're reaching out to families because we are required to put a report into the state where we have to be over 99% compliant on either children being fully vaccinated or the parents having a waiver on file. We are having those conversations every fall for a couple of months where we're getting that information, helping get students updated. And in conversations I've been having in the last few days, I think that is where those opportunities occur, because people now, if you've been in a district for a while, you have those relationships, people trust you, and there's that opportunity where the door opens and they say, what is your opinion on this? Or what do you think about that? Or I've heard this, what do you know about that? And it's definitely individual. So I think that progress is slow, but I would say in the 10 years I've been doing it, I've definitely seen those opportunities to have those conversations with parents who I've made relationships with and trust me.
Talk a little more about what these conversations are like, because the impression I'm getting from what you've said so far is you don't go into this as an adversarial, right? It's not you against them, and it's an argument. How do you approach these conversations?
Well, I guess in my nursing career, I think I probably have learned patience probably through trial and error. And I think one of my catchphrases has always been, an educated patient is a compliant patient, is a happy patient. You don't want to be forcing things on anybody. And people who understand the why and the how are really a lot more compliant with their plan of care and with what needs to happen to make them healthier. So kind of, as I said, I think it's everybody kind of has to earn their stripes of trust. And so as their children are running into different scenarios or at school where I'm contacting them, or the child is diagnosed with something, or they're needing advice or a place to sound something off of, then they've learned my breadth of experience and capacity and professionalism. And then they are more likely to come back when something like immunizations come up and say, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Because I've established myself as somebody who's an expert within my own field, and that helps.
You mentioned one reason somebody might not be vaccinated if parents have become skeptical of vaccines for whatever reason. How about just information? Maybe somebody just moved. They don't know about the requirements. They don't know where to go for vaccinations yet. Or maybe English is a second language. They just don't have direct contact with that kind of information. How much of a factor is that?
Yeah, I think that is. Those are conversations we fortunately get to start in on pretty early in that enrollment process when people are new to our state. In the state of Wisconsin, we do have a whole year before they kind of count on our rolls towards that compliance number. But that gives us a whole year to make sure that we're connecting them with those local resources. If they're coming from another state, what are differences from one state to another, or certainly if they're coming from another country, what those differences are from their home country to another. And I've seen a lot of those families from both different states or different countries really prepared with having what they need and ready to engage in that conversation. And we've had really good results linking with our county resources, our county nurses, and making sure that we're getting those families' needs met.
Getting back to measles, we were looking at the CDC data. We're not too bad in Wisconsin, at least not right now, but we saw our neighbors, Minnesota, Illinois, have some higher rates of measles compared to the country as a whole. As we get back to another school year, do you kind of worry that, you know, something like measles might be breathing down our neck?
Yeah, you know, I was watching all that stuff. You know, it's ironic, even before the COVID pandemic hit, that was something that we were always tracking. I think that unfortunately, people think of school nurses as somebody who's doing just Band-Aids and bumps and bruises and things like that. And it's much, much more complex. They don't think of it as a subspecialty like an ICU or an ER, but, you know, we're actually functioning very high in our own realm of subspecialty in what we've got going on. So I'm always tracking those illnesses. Even before the pandemic, like I was saying, I was tracking those ILI sheets that the Department of Health and Human Services puts out, which is the influenza-like illness, and watching things as they come in. So we're always out here and we're always monitoring those things as they touch on our borders and monitoring things for students who have issues with immunity. There are some kids who may even need infusions if they have poor immunity of certain factors, if they are concerned that the child might be exposed to something that would typically be a live virus vaccine. Not all kids can get those. So, you know, then we have to make sure that we're helping keep those families in touch with what their child needs. So I'm always watching it, always hoping that it doesn't end up hitting the fan like it has in the past. But we're out here watching and we're ready to be helping. We're ready to be helping people when they need us. So
as we get back to another school year, apart from, you know, measles, we've talked about, you just mentioned influenza and influenza like respiratory illnesses. What else keeps you up at night as we come into a school year and you're watching for what might show up in students this fall?
Well, everything is that I'm going into my 11th school year. Everything kind of has its season. You know, spring is always rashes. So we got through that. Fall, you know, typically we're back into a little bit of hand, foot, and mouth and other certain things like that. Unfortunately, some of those more intestinal bugs hit us usually by October. But as we start a new school year, I'm usually really thinking about my higher needs kids, the kids who are more medically complex and who a lot of people don't think of when they think about students in schools. So I'm always thinking about those students and what's changed over those last couple of months and what new challenges and opportunities we have with those particular student populations as our new school year starts.
We are talking about back to school health and school vaccinations with Jamie Trebetusky, Wapaka school nurse and president of the Wisconsin School Nurses Association. Jamie, I want to talk about your role now as president of the School Nurses Association. Big picture, do we have enough school nurses in our schools? Are they stretched too thin?
No, we don't have enough. And I think anybody who's had an unfortunate experience, maybe where they've been inpatient, right? Recently, they've experienced that across healthcare, is that unfortunately we're spread rather thin with staffing levels right now. And the same is true in your schools and your communities. I think it's best reports we're able to get. It's only about 75% of schools across Wisconsin have a school nurse. And people who think that doesn't make a difference if that person's what level training they have, whether it's an EMT or a CNA, it absolutely makes a difference if that person has a degree in nursing. And there's not enough. And the degree level of that person and their background and capacity to function at the highest level of their degree makes a big difference too. So.
And then we had some federal pandemic relief money that might have helped things. That's coming to an end now. We're hearing that school districts are considering budget cuts, and that could include more limits on the number of nurses. Are you seeing, as you talk to people around the state, these positions being cut or, as you mentioned, maybe scaled back to somebody with less training?
I hear of some of it. I hear of some of it, you know, off and on through time. Yeah, I think definitely those ESSER funds helped. And that's part of why, as an organization, we're trying to educate legislators on that reimbursement that we spoke with to you guys in the spring when we were in Madison, that right now, the state of Wisconsin is only returning 60% of that funds back to schools, whereas 100% of it is going back when those students are in birth to three programs and getting service through the county. So we're really hoping in this next cycle, we can get some traction on getting that reimbursement rate for schools matching. When you look at places like Healthy Schools, who really kind of live in that data, Wisconsin's an outlier on that percentage that schools are getting reimbursed. So we'd really like to see that specific funding for services that are already being provided help supported for schools so that it's easier for them to continue to hold those positions because they have that direct revenue stream.
you mentioned your career, Jamie, leading up to this. Can you talk about your career as a nurse and what led you to say, hey, I want to take these skills and put them into use in the Waupaca schools?
I actually started in Milwaukee. I spent the first part of my career in internal medicine pulmonary at Frederick Hospital, then in emergency medicine and trauma. Then I was in primary care and case management in central Wisconsin, and also still moonlighting in the ER, which was my first love. And then after a decade, I felt I had enough experience with seeing kind of a jack of all trades, a lot of background and a lot of different medical complexity that I felt I could serve my community and serve children in that capacity. So it's a big job, me versus 1200 on some days, but it's, I really love it. I love being challenged, and I love trying to rise to those challenges. So it's been great.
Talk us through a day on the job as a school nurse. And I won't say typical day. I'm going to guess there is no such thing, but what might a day on the job look like as a school nurse?
I have direct cares with medically complex kids who have need for my special skill set and training. And then it is also kind of supporting, in my district, we have health aides who work under our licenses, where they're kind of calling us in for this whole, is it concussed? Is it broken? Is it contagious type of thing? And then networking with families to make sure that they're educated on what's going on with their children while they're away from their parents during the school day. So it's all that in between. So the direct care of children and making sure that those direct care points are taken care of for the kids who need that skill set, and then handling whatever comes up throughout the day is what comes next, and supporting teachers. I'm a resource for the staff a fair amount of the time too. And I'm amazed every day at the professionalism and capability of my coworkers. And I'm happy to try to remove that, the lens of the health needs of the students away from them so they can better do their jobs.
For somebody who's currently a nurse in whatever field or a nurse of the future, do you want to make a pitch to at least consider becoming a school nurse?
I think it's one of the places where it's probably you're the most out there alone working underneath your professional license, but it is so rewarding to be working at the top of your professional capacity and using your skill set to make students and your community healthier and be a resource for people in that way. It's really an amazing subspecialty within the field of nursing.
Let's bring things around to kids and vaccines as we head into the school year. I'm a parent. My kids are out of the school system now. But there's a lot of bureaucracy in parenting. I'm pretty sure we kept all with all our vaccines, but I know I had moments just like, are we up to date? Are we ready for September? Give some advice for parents. Like, if they're not sure if they're up to date on vaccines, how do they figure it out? How do they know what they need to get done?
Sure, that's a great question. So the Wisconsin Immunization Registry actually gives parents access to their child's immunization history so they can see it there. Usually every platform within, if they've got like some type of My Chart through whatever their organization is locally where they go to the doctor, usually will have immunizations as part of that. And they should probably be able to see what they are due for or what's upcoming with their child's needs. And then always a good idea to get in for those annual wellness visits. You know, it's always better to stay ahead of issues before they occur. And primary care providers are there to take care of those needs and make sure they're looking for those things before problems arise.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you the biggest, most difficult question as a parent of kids in school, the question of, is my kid too sick to send to school? What can you give us some basic advice? This is too sick. This they can rock and roll and come on in.
Well, I can't speak for every school district because it is local control in Wisconsin. So every school district has their own policy. So certainly check with your school nurse and your health services guidelines. But I would say in general, we don't want your kid at school if you have been vomiting or having diarrhea in the last 24 hours. We don't want you at school if you have a fever in the last 24 hours. You need to be fever free without help of Tylenol or acetaminophen or ibuprofen. And if your child is not, you know, well enough to attend, you know, certainly that's the other outlier. If they've got something that's fever, vomiting, diarrhea, or they're just not well enough to be at school. If they can't sit down and in a desk and do the things that their teacher's going to be asking them to do because they just need a little bit more time to convalesce, then just please let them stay home and rest one more day before they come back.
Jamie, thanks for joining us and have a happy and healthy school year.
Yes, thank you so much.
Jamie Trebetusky is president of the Wisconsin Association of School Nurses and a school nurse for the School District of Waupaca.
We love to hear from you, and we recently asked if your community has any sister city connections.
We heard from Marge in Madison, who wrote in to say their spouse is a past president of the Madison-Fribourg Sister City Committee. It was founded in the 1980s to promote exchanges and contacts between the cities of Madison and Fribourg, Germany.
Through that, Marge says they've hosted students and adults and delegations from Fribourg and arranged events with the city of Madison. The most memorable, Marge says, was having young people staying with us for a week or two and showing them all of what Madison has to offer.
And then Marge says, when we traveled to Fribourg, Germany, we were treated like royalty and learned about that city's commitment to the environment. Marge thinks Madison has learned a lot from Fribourg.
Get in touch with us and share the special connections in your community and what makes it unique. Send an email to wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
We always look forward to hearing what you've got to say. And thanks so much for listening to Wisconsin Today.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a family-run chocolate shop in Elm Grove wins Best of Show at the State Fair for a sweet confection.
It starts out with a crunchy cookie base, and it's got that creamy cheesecake flavor in the middle, and then it's got that burst of the berry marmalade.
The Art and Science of Chocolate on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A family-run chocolate shop in Elm Grove is celebrating its best of show at this year's Wisconsin State Fair for a treat they created to celebrate a decade in business.
Okay, Rob, you are the master of treats. Hold on to your seat for this. It's a dark chocolate praline crunch layered with berry marmalade and cheesecake in a dark chocolate shell.
Kate, you had me a dark chocolate praline crunch layered with berry marmalade and cheesecake in a dark chocolate shell. How do I get on the list of judges for this?
I think you missed your calling, but we have the winning chocolatier, Cindy Carls, who joins us. She's co-owner of Fazio's Chocolate. Cindy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
So you created artistry here in this confection called Decade of Decadence. What stands out to you when you bite into it?
Well, what stands out to me is the different flavor profiles that we had to make the chocolate. It starts out with a crunchy cookie base, and then it's got that creamy cheesecake flavor in the middle, and then it's got that burst of the berry marmalade. So it's definitely the three different flavors that come out so well.
How did you decide to put these ingredients and flavors together?
It takes a while to come up with a new flavor, and you try different things. You basically try things. And sometimes they come together. Then maybe you have to change one element of it. Sometimes when you look at different types of foods in the world, say like a piece of cheesecake, that might give you some kind of inspiration. And then you try to turn it into a chocolate. And I would have to say that this is almost like biting into a little mini cheesecake.
It's like your kitchen is a kind of science lab for you.
Yes, it is.
Is this your first year that you've submitted a suite for awards at the State Fair?
Yes, it is. It was always on my bucket list. It was something that we would see as a family. We would go to State Fair because it's one of our favorite things to do. And a must-see would always be the Grand Champion Hall with all of the homemade items. And it is an amazing building with a lot of wonderful items in it. And I would say, geez, I should really enter something. So I finally got on the email list last year. And when the email came, we took a look at it and said, hey, this is something that we can do.
It was always on in the back of your mind that you really wanted to submit something. A little bit about your life. You were a flight attendant in Milwaukee for years before turning your attention to chocolate. What was the biggest surprise to you in turning away from a very different career and really focusing on confections?
Well, being a flight attendant was very energizing, active, always going different places. And reinventing yourself is something where you have to dig down deep inside of yourself and you have to try and find something that you've always enjoyed. And that was cooking and baking. I've always enjoyed that. I cooked with my grandmother, my mother, my aunts. And so I was able to go back to school and I wasn't sure if I wanted to cook or bake. So I took a class on pastry arts. I thought pastries were so beautiful. We did a section on chocolate, and that was it for me. I enjoy art, and chocolate is so fun to incorporate art and molding figures and different flavors. And it just went from there. And from probably active, always something different, going different places to really thinking of how do you want to start this out? How do you want to do a signature line of chocolates? And when you do, how do you want them to look? How do you want them to taste? Those kind of things.
Cindy, how does chocolate challenge you?
Oh, this week especially, it's very warm outside. Chocolate really loves it cold outside. So that's one challenge. The weather, the humidity is another challenge. You always have to have something new. People love new things. We at the store switch up for holidays and for just different seasons. So that's how we do it. We have our summer line with key lime, wild berry cup, margarita. Mm-hmm. But with the fall entering now, we will have our autumn crunch and our pumpkin and things like that. So that's the challenge.
How does your Italian heritage emerge from what you create?
So that would be referring to our gondola, which is on our website. And the signature line of chocolates is very much the Italian background. And it started with coming up with Leonardo's favorite, which has a hazelnut in it, which is very, very popular in the Italian culture. And then we went on to Maria's Bellini, which is a peach Bellini, a very light, peachy, kind of creamy chocolate. And then, of course, the red port wine. And, of course, Amore for love. And then Spumoni. Yes. And then Spumoni, because it's such a very popular Italian flavor. And along with Fragola Balsamic, which is a strawberry. So we took all of those flavors, all of those names, and it all came together as one. And that is our signature line for our store.
It is so creative. Where does that creativity bubble up inside you? How are you able to transfer that into just such a delicate art of creating these chocolates?
Well, first of all, I was blessed with the gift of creativity and the vision. Sometimes it's amazing. It's something that's inside of me. But again, you can be inspired by the colors of autumn. I mean, just think of the leaves falling from the trees. You can be inspired from being on a beach and thinking of a pina colada. And then there's Christmas with all the wonderful songs. I am inspired sometimes by Christmas songs. So we'll take the name and then we'll take the name along with the flavor. And we have one that's called Snow Crunch. So then we make sure it has a little bit of crunch in it. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that really inspire me.
It's like you try to work with all the senses when people bite into your chocolates to really engage someone with what they're experiencing in that moment.
Yes, we really do. We hear a lot of times it's, that looks too pretty to eat, or oh my goodness, how did you get that one? How did you get that design on there? And it's really fun. It's fun to hit all those senses. And that is something that you do when you try to come up with a new creation. When you say Spumoni, you want it to taste like Spumoni, and you want all of those flavors to come out.
We're talking about award-winning chocolate from the State Fair with Cindy Carls of Elm Grove, co-owner of Fazio's Chocolate. Cindy, what do home bakers often misunderstand about the chemistry of working with chocolate? I mean, you mentioned heat, not a good thing, humidity, difficult. What is going on with that chemistry?
The chemistry that's involved, a lot of people think it's really easy to work with because they're usually getting something from their local grocer or craft store, and that's not a true couverture. What it is for us that we're working with is we are working with an actual couverture where the different crystals have to come together. And that does entail, like you just said, a cool room, low humidity, and it's an art, and it's actually a trade. And when you train somebody, they will see how the chocolate looks before it's in temper. It's thin and runny. And once it gets in temper, it's that beautiful working temperature where you get that really nice thin shell and that really nice snap. Mm. But once it starts to get too thick, that's again where it starts to bloom on you, and there's nothing wrong with it. It just doesn't look as good. But generally, if you're getting it from a store or one of your local craft stores, you basically warm it up, pour it in a mold, and it's done. It just has different ingredients with it, so it acts differently. But this is actually a high-end chocolate that we're working with.
You're also experimenting and working with vegan chocolates, dairy-free as well. What trends have you noticed in chocolates over the years?
Well, that was one of the trends that was very big, also gluten-free.
Mm-hmm.
So, and recently they're coming out with different chocolates that have more proteins in them so that people can, you know, like say with a pea protein. And those are a lot of the trends that are happening right now. Also different spices. There's a lot of Indian spices that are coming into the industry right now. It's ever changing. You always want to take a class or, you know, collaborate with another chocolatier and just try to be on the top of those trends and see if it fits in your business. Hmm. You know, is somebody going to want something with Eastern Indian spices and a crunch, or are they going to want their sea salt caramel? We at our store offer three different types of things. We have the traditional, where you've got your sea salt caramels, your toffees, your nut clusters. We also have the artisan.
Or I should say the tried and true.
Yes. Yes. We also have truffles, the liqueur truffles that, you know, people just love. And those are creamy, and the liqueur is boiled out of it, of course. But that actual punch of, you know, Kahlua coffee in there, if you will, just adds to the flavor of it. And then, of course, yes, the vegan is very popular.
There are issues around how to source cacao and buy ethical chocolate, in part due to a lack of transparency in supply chains. How do you try to source your ingredients in an ethical way? What do you think about on this issue?
Well, Fazio's Chocolate is very proud to work with the Parados company, and they have implemented a program called Coco Trace. Within that program, they work with the farmers, and they're part of their Parados team has gone and taught them different farming skills, which made them more efficient, and that in turn helped them produce more volume, which leads them to more of a stable financial future. And that helps them to achieve their dreams. So they formed a community with these farmers. Hmm. And this Coco Trace program changed their lives. Now, with the Cocoa Trace program, for every 2 pounds of chocolate that Fazio's Chocolates buys, we give back 10 cents. That's just part of the program. And that goes directly back to the producers of the chocolate. So that provides them with water, electricity, schools for the children, and it creates a better life for all of them. And who doesn't have dreams that want to come true, right? Mm-hmm. And there's regular reports on all of this. It's all on file. So if you, I invite anyone to take a look at it. It's called Puratos, Puratos.com. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful program. They continue to meet their goals and they continue to have more goals for more education and helping the people and teaching them even more skills. It's a wonderful program. And we've only used this chocolate for the last 10 years. We've not used any other chocolate. This is the one we use because we believe so strongly in a wonderful life for the people who are producing this product for us.
Cindy, the State Fair top prize, that blue ribbon and your glowing face holding it. You know, what else is on your bucket list for your business? What would you like to achieve next?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're looking into wholesaling. We have a very strong foothold in our retail business in Elm Grove where we're located. So we were looking to, you know, wholesale. And one of the things that we've just recently done is we're partnering with Friends of the Domes to help secure their future. And it's a wonderful partnership. We were able to make a chocolate for each one of the domes. So we came up with a lizard for the desert dome. We came up with a frog for the tropical dome and then a little flower pot for their show dome. And it's something that is such an iconic part of Milwaukee. It also provides education for all ages and activities. And it's just a wonderful place to escape in the cold Wisconsin winter. So, that's one of the things. And we're starting to branch out. And that was one of them that we started just recently. And it's been wonderful.
Cindy, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Cindy Carls is a chocolatier and co-owner of Fazio's Chocolate in Elm Grove, winning first place and best of show at this year's Wisconsin State Fair.
Hey, you can listen online anytime at WPR.org. Check out our live stream or archived audio. And if you want to share something with friends or family, you can do that there too. Find it all online at WPR.org.
In coming days, we're going to explore the political campaign memorabilia that is part of the collections at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
And fresh off the party conventions in Milwaukee and Chicago, the Historical Society's collected even more buttons, signs, and other things the delegates showed off.
Which has us wondering, are you a collector of political buttons or other historically significant items? What do you love about these pieces? What stories do they convey about Wisconsin politics?
Email us now at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232 to tell us about your political memorabilia collecting hobby.
And let us know how you started and your coolest finds. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.